It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Haiti is the poorest country in North and South America. The population is estimated to be at about 8.7 million people. And in 2003, 80% of those people were thought to be living below the poverty line. That was before the devastating earthquake of January 2010. Dr. Christopher Burrish is an assistant clinical professor and the director of international emergency medicine in the Department of Emergency Medicine at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. He's been going to Haiti regularly since 2003. Ever since his first experience providing medical care there, he's been trying to figure out ways to provide more lasting and meaningful assistance. Community Health Initiative Haiti, or CHI Haiti, grew out of that desire. He co-founded the group with another physician in 2012, and he is here in the studio with me today. Hello, Dr. Burrish.
Hi there.
Thank you so much for being here today. And I want to go back to 2003. That first trip to Haiti was something of an impulse trip, I understand. What was your experience on that first visit?
It was pretty amazing. And honestly, it's something I think about, I think, almost every day since that trip. I went with a group called the Children's Nutrition Program of Haiti that is based out of North Carolina and Tennessee. And It was really eye-opening. I mean, I'd done some work in India and Peru and a few other places, and there were a lot of things about Haiti that reminded me of those other places. I mean, some of the same sights and smells and sounds, but it really blew me away that it was literally a 90-minute flight from Miami that all this was happening. And so I think that I kind of knew this is the work that I'd always wanted to do. And Haiti just seemed like a great place to do it because it was really close, but also the people were just amazing. I mean, they're just so giving and so welcoming. And, you know, you'd show up in a village and these people that had nothing would bring out all this food that must be more than they'd eat in a week. So I was just really touched, I guess. And since then, I've grown to have some amazing friends in Haiti.
Over the years before founding this group, did you go with a variety of different groups, or what were your interactions in Haiti? Because you were going quite frequently.
Yeah, I started out going once a year, and then it sort of ramped up gradually. And so we did. We went with the Children's Nutrition Program for a number of years and then decided that we wanted to kind of take the medical care in a different direction and pick a few villages and just go back every 3 months so that we could start providing really continuous primary care and follow people. Hopefully see them improve and help them through these kind of prolonged illnesses. And so we started doing that in 2008. And then in 2010, the earthquake hit, and we were with a group called Worldwide Village at that point. We got sidetracked from our primary care mission and ended up setting up a big field hospital and spent probably 6 or 8 months really pretty intensely involved with that before kind of getting back on track.
And you were in Haiti just days before that earthquake hit, right?
Right, yeah. We left, our big trip had finished, I think, 3 days before the earthquake. And then we made it, it took us about another 6 days after the earthquake to get back.
Now, of course, so many of us saw all of these images on television and listened to the extensive radio reports about what that earthquake did to Haiti, and it was so devastating. But having been there 3 days before it hit and then returning a week later, what did you see?
It was really weird. I mean, it was really surreal. You know, it was a totally different place. You know, it was landmarks that you used to kind of count on for navigation and things that you would see as you drove around just weren't there anymore. And just people were, I think a lot of people were still really in a state of shock, and walking around trying to figure out how to just sort of meet their basic needs. I mean, I think it's usually kind of a struggle to do that, but even more so really, you know, a lot of people were moving, you know, buses heading out of Port-au-Prince were just packed full of people. I mean, it was a very strange experience.
After spending all this time going back every 3 months to try to establish primary care for people in remote places, and then to have this earthquake hit, did you feel a little hopeless, like everything that you'd done fell apart?
You know, it is kind of funny. I remember on January 9th heading back to the airport after our trip and thinking, man, things are really picking up. I mean, things are really going our way. It's really incredible. I mean, because we were seeing such huge improvements in the populations that we were helping. And you know, throughout the country, there were some really great things happening. I mean, there were some really great efforts to clean up the streets. I mean, it used to take, 4 or 5 hours to move 20 miles because these huge mountains of garbage. And those were starting to disappear. There were some cash for work programs going on. And I remember having this feeling of, wow, this is really spectacular. And then, 3 days later, everything falls down. I guess after the earthquake, though, you just don't have that much time to sort of reflect on the bigger picture because you're so busy just trying to take care of whatever the most pressing need is right in front of you. I think that after a few weeks and you see all these resources coming to bear, then you do sort of get a little bit more hopeful that wow, now that people are finally paying attention to Haiti, now that it's finally on the radar screen, maybe we'll start to see some big improvement. Now that there's all this investment and this commitment, maybe this is a chance to, as Bill Clinton would say, build back better and put in place some real honest-to-goodness infrastructure. I don't know. Optimists are always kind of punished a little bit when they start thinking.
Right. So the world descends on Haiti to bring assistance, but the world left again.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think there's still a few people that are there. And I think that, before the earthquake, they're estimating there's something like 10,000 non-governmental organizations working in Haiti. And I don't know that anybody's bothered to do a head count since then, but it's more. And so I think people are still there. It's just more fragmented. And unfortunately, the government they don't raise any tax money or much tax money. And they don't have the finances to run a real infrastructure and have a hard time coordinating all of this stuff. And it's not that they don't want to. It's just that it's, there's only so much they can pull off.
So with 10,000 NGOs in Haiti, why did you decide that you needed to start your own?
Why one more? And that's, we thought about it for years, honestly. I mean, we had talked about it for about 2 years before we decided to start our own. I think that at the end of the day, the group that we had been working with, I think was, we were just having a hard time sort of accounting for money, essentially, and tracking the finances, and which made it impossible really to go out and ask people for money if I wasn't sure that I knew where it was going. And so I wanted to be able to be more accountable and have some more direct oversight of that. And there wasn't anybody working, doing what we wanted to do, where we wanted to do it. And so I think that a combination of those two things, there wasn't somebody that had the same mission, but also this gave us the ability to really be accountable that we didn't have before.
So in putting this group together, you began official work in 2012,
mm-hmm.
and then operated all throughout 2013. How did you change your focus? You had talked about going out to these more remote areas every 3 months and trying to establish primary care, but you've changed your approach with your new organization.
We have. I think that really pretty quickly we realized that it's better to try and keep people healthy than to try and take care of them once they get sick. And so within about 6 months, we had a couple of medical students from the university here go down and do some really impressive survey work. I think one guy named Matt Downen, who's in Kansas now, visited something like 216 houses over this huge area, our catchment area, and interviewed, I think his interviews represented something like 1,200 people, and found out that 35% of houses had had kids die in the last few years, like 150 kids. From fever and diarrhea and voodoo. And I don't know how to treat the voodoo, but the fever and diarrhea seem like something that are pretty easy to get after. And it just seems stupid. Honestly stupid that kids in this area, 90-minute plane flight from Miami, are starving to death and dying of diarrhea. And super frustrating. I mean, really, it's the kind of thing that makes it hard to sleep at night, once you've met a few of these kids. After that, we did the survey, and then we started meeting with the community, and these people have amazing insight into what they need, and so we would share our survey results with them, and they'd say, well, yeah, we already knew that, so we said, well, we think you need water and, like, latrines, and they said, yeah, absolutely, but what we really want first is a bridge, and I thought, boy, we don't know anything about building bridges, but there's actually a group that's run by a lady from Coralville called Bridges to Prosperity that jumped in and were willing to build a bridge. And then the community decided they wanted something bigger they could drive a truck over. And so we ended up putting in a road. And it's amazing when it comes to health and really kind of everything about that community, how transformational a road is. Before
Why?
Because they couldn't get to they would have to walk everywhere. You know, they're the only community on the far side of this river, and they have to go up all these concrete steps to get over the river. And when the water's real high, I think that can be a little dodgy. And so anything with hooves or wheels can't get there. And so it makes it hard to build houses. It makes it hard to get your crops to market. It's hard to get sick people to the hospital or women that are in labor. You can't dig a well. I mean, really, you have to dig it by hand. And so if you want to put anything deeper than 60 feet, I mean, you have to get down to about 100 feet before it's clean water. If you want to put anything deeper than 60 feet, you really need a truck. So we rented a dump truck, and they built the road. And they're an amazing community, because that's the way it always happens, is we provide just this little bit of infrastructure, just enough. We just lower the bar enough that they can do it, and then they do all the work. And in fact, when we've tried to pay them for the work, they say, you know, you're not taking this road with you when you leave, so we're not going to let you pay us.
So having the road allowed you to dig two wells in this community. And you've also taken other steps to try to help people filter their water. What are you doing with that?
We have a program called Gardien de l'eau, which is Creole for water guardian. And it was started a while ago and then scaled up by some guys from Emory University in a group called Deep Springs International. And it's a point-of-use water treatment system. So basically, treat the water at your house. So we surveyed the water. So all these kids were dying from diarrhea. We thought, this is stupid. Let's figure out what's going on. And it turns out 70% of people drink out of the river. You know, about 20% of people buy their water from trucks, and about 8 or 9% of people have wells. And so we went around and tested all the water, and 98% of it was full of bacteria from people or animal colons, and which makes people really sick. And then we kind of watched how people, even the water from the truck that was usually pretty good, what happens, people take their dusty buckets and they rinse them off in the river and then fill them up with the truck. And so as soon as the water hits the bucket, it's filthy. And so we decided we'd treat the water at the house. And so we have these buckets with a spigot so that people don't have to reach their hands in there. And you put a cap full of concentrated chlorine in there, and you wait for 30 minutes, and then the bucket's treated. And that chlorine hangs around for 3 days. So even if somebody would inadvertently contaminate it in the next 3 days, it would be treated. So then we go around every month, and we check the buckets, and we test for chlorine, and we test for bacteria. And we ask people if they have had diarrhea, and the results are staggering. I mean, it has dropped diarrhea in some cases by 60-70%. And it's $10 for a bucket. That's the retail cost for the bucket. And then people buy more chlorine every month. They buy a dollar's worth of chlorine every month, and that lasts them for the month. And then that, by them doing that, that sustains the program, self-sustaining. You know.
In reading about your work, I was taken by some of the very simple solutions that you're offering, like the chlorine buckets, but also by making sure that women who are pregnant have something clean to cut their baby's umbilical cord with after birth. Why is that such an important initiative? It sounds so simple.
I mean, it's amazing kind of what we take for granted here, right? Like you can turn on the faucet and you don't have to worry about drinking the water, or you have to go to the bathroom and there's somewhere you can go where nobody's going to watch you go to the bathroom and it's not going to run into the river. And that's another sort of example that, you know, when you have to cut the baby's umbilical cord, surely there's going to be something clean to cut it with. But there's not. They cut with rocks or glass or metal. And so we don't know how many babies die of tetanus every year, but probably a lot. And if not tetanus, then certainly other infections can get them as well. And so, you know, there's a lot of babies that die in that really early neonatal period. And so when women are pregnant in their last trimester of pregnancy, or in the last half of their pregnancy, really, we give them a kit that has just a clean razor blade, some clean string, and a couple of blankets to dry the baby. And then we've also started teaching the lay midwives. So 86% of people deliver at home. And they have these community members that have delivered babies before, sometimes just their own, but they kind of put themselves out there as midwives. And so we're teaching them how to do neonatal resuscitation now. And we've just got a grant to study that and see. We're thinking that we can drop neonatal mortality by 90% in that first couple of days of life just by teaching them to suck the baby's mouth out and dry the baby off and stimulate it a little bit.
In your first full year of operation, you saw 8,700 patients. Mm-hmm. You obviously, we've talked about your clean water initiative and digging wells, building a road. What does the future look like? What are your needs and what are your hopes?
Wow. Well, so I think it looks pretty good, honestly. I'm pretty excited about it. Just 2 days ago, we had a recycling center show up. It won't be in our community, but it'll be in the biggest town a couple of miles away from our community where people can collect plastic. And there's plastic everywhere. They bring in 40,000 pounds a day to an island or a country the size of the state of Maryland. And it all gets thrown on the ground. And so people bring in this plastic that normally clogs up, you know, drains and canals and the ocean. And we'll pay them for it, and then we sell it in Port-au-Prince, and it gets chipped up and made into, like, my messenger bag or a polar fleece or something like that. And so people can generate enough income through just picking up plastic to send a kid to school or to buy some protein for their family. And so our recycling center is right across the street from the market, so it's like an ATM machine. And so that's going to open up in the next few weeks, and just having it show up is a huge victory. About 2 weeks ago, we put in the first solar light in our community. So they're... You know, 3 weeks ago, they were 4 miles from the nearest light. So when the sun went down, it was just dark. And they didn't have anywhere to plug anything in. So this light has 6 outlets and is totally off the grid. And so that's pretty great. I think that moving forward, one of the wells we dug turned out to be kind of salty. You know, honestly, everybody was so nice about it. They used it for about a year before they finally complained about the taste. And it turns out it's probably 2.5 times too salty to drink. And it's probably twice as salty as you can use for irrigation. So hopefully we'll be kind of looking into this solar-powered reverse osmosis system that will clean the water but also generate the salt that we need to make the chlorine for our drinking water program and should also power a nearby orphanage. So there's a lot going on. We'd really kind of decided this year we were going to try to not grow as much and work on infrastructure, but it's hard to look at the need and the opportunity and ignore it.
Dr. Burrish, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Dr. Christopher Burrish is co-founder of Community Health Initiative Haiti. You can find out more about the group, including a major benefit event coming up in Iowa City on August 2nd on their website, chihaiti.org. And yesterday, Dr. Burrish was presented with the Governor's Individual Volunteer Award for 2014. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
And you're listening on Iowa Public Radio. Next up, it's Fresh Air with host Terry Gross. Flash flood watch for portions of northern Iowa today through tomorrow morning. Highs ranging mid-80s north to mid-90s in the southwest for tonight. Isolated thunderstorms expected, lows upper 60s to mid-70s. It's 11 o'clock.